Long before apps like Duolingo brought language learning to our fingertips, Ireland was leading the charge in European language education. During the second half of the 19th century, further education in Britain and Ireland experienced many changes as increasing attention was paid to the study of modern European languages, especially in the upper echelons of society. This process was more pronounced here than it was in Britain. Ireland's colleges embraced language study, ancient and modern, Irish and European, more eagerly than their British counterparts, and Ireland saw an influx of European teachers. Irish educators were instrumental in this period of change, welcoming modern language learning and later playing an important role in the rise of the Gaelic League, forging a bond between language, education and politics. To learn more about this, I'm joined by author and historian Dr. Phyllis Gaffney, author of the recently published Foreign Tongues, Victorian Language Learning and Modern Ireland. Phyllis, you're very welcome indeed to the History Show.
Thank you very much, Miles.
Can you describe for our listeners the school system in Ireland, more particularly, I suppose, the secondary school system, in mid-19th century, the early years of the Victorian era, and the part that foreign languages played in the curriculum of those schools?
Really, there's no system when you're talking about the 19th century. There's a very eclectic range of types of school available, from endowed Anglican schools to so-called hedge schools or pay schools with itinerant masters, to convent schools and elite boarding schools and so on and so forth. So modern language availability varied enormously within that infrastructure. It was in many establishments, traditionally a modern language was an extra the parents paid extra for. As the Lewis Carroll's Mock Turtle tells Alice, and I quote, "French music and washing were extra in his school." There was some reality in that. It wasn't just Wonderland. But for Ireland, there's evidence that suggests that by the 1860s, I suppose we can say, their modern languages are much more present than they are in England, in the Irish intermediate school sector, which is the, you know, post-primary. Alongside classics, we mustn't forget that classics were also taught. It was Latin and Greek plus French or German, mostly French. In fact, French was by far the most studied, much the same today.
But is this because of the historic connections between Ireland and France?
Yeah, but there were historic connections between Ireland and Rome, Ireland and Spain. You know, it was Ireland and France for various reasons. One was that French was important for trade. Also, French had been part of medieval, late medieval Ireland. Hiberno-Norman was spoken here. And there are some gravestones with inscriptions in Hiberno-French, I should say. And most rising middle-class families from the Catholic community were in trade because of the penal restrictions. You know, proportionally, much fewer of them were owned land. Mm. And there's one striking example of a post-primary school where French was absolutely not an extra, like washing or fencing or dancing. It was Blackrock College. It was the French College, and it was set up in Blackrock in County Dublin in 1860. And this is the ancestor of today's Blackrock College, of famous or infamous note.
And French was the working language in Blackrock.
It was founded by French Holy Ghost fathers who came to Ireland because they wanted to set up a seminary to train Anglophone missionaries in their missions. But they realised as soon as they got here that what was needed much more was a post-primary school in South Dublin for the increasingly large cohort of middle-class Irish Catholics. So until the end of the 19th century, the boys in Blackrock were entirely schooled through French. They had French textbooks, a French curriculum, French uniforms. They were known locally as the Boney Boys. That's B-O-N-E-Y.
As
in Bonaparte, yeah. French was the language of daily communication. All the masters but one were Francophone. And this actually lasted until 1896 or so. It lasted for about a good 30, 40 years.
So essentially it was a lycée.
It was really. And the level of French that they taught me, and I've looked at the archives there, it's astonishing. You could do a PhD on that. But they also offered German, Italian and Spanish. And those subjects were not extra as they were in some schools. So the Blackrock formula proved highly successful. So there must have been a need for it and an interest. The school kept expanding and it expanded its reach. And it prepared its schools for the competitive examinations which came in. They had been introduced after the Northcote Trevelyan report of the mid-1850s for civil service recruitment in Britain and Ireland, where there was a shift from the older system of patronage and privilege to public examinations. Mm. And the really interesting thing about that period was that modern languages were for the first time given official recognition for those exams.
And so, were modern languages more important perhaps in Ireland than they were in Britain? Because were we slightly less obsessed with the classics than they were in Britain?
Absolutely. We were. Ireland had far fewer hang-ups about the sacrosanct place of classics in education. In English universities, you can see, I mean, the universities dictate what gets done in the post-primary. In English universities, there was sustained resistance to modern subjects, such as modern languages and history, on the grounds that they would deflect resources and, of course, students from the business that was the real core business of universities, traditional universities, which was to teach Greek and Latin.
Boris Johnson and would approve.
Absolutely. The classics were stoutly defended by the likes of William Gladstone in 1861, and of a quote from him, "Science, modern languages or history had," and I quote, "no right to a parallel or equal position. Their true position is ancillary to the old classical training." And for Thomas Arnold, who was a classical authors or honorary Victorians, he says they're virtually our own countrymen and contemporaries.
So this is the headmaster of rugby school.
Yes, yes. So in the mid-19th century, only two universities in England offered modern languages. They were optional, like fencing or dancing. They weren't regarded as serious university subjects, whereas it was very different over here.
Well, what about our universities? What about
extremely different here. All of Ireland's university institutions offered modern languages, alongside Greek and Latin, of course. Mustn't forget them. Trinity had been the first in the world with its chairs of 1776, chairs of French with German and Italian with Spanish. Maynooth offered French. In fact, half the staff of Maynooth were refugees from the French Revolution. Ireland's three Queen's Colleges, founded in 1849 in Belfast, Cork and Galway, went further than Trinity, making all students take French or German as a core curriculum requirement. So this applied to all students, art students, medicine, engineering, and you couldn't get a degree in Belfast, Cork or Galway if you didn't prove a satisfactory level of French or German. Newman's Catholic University, which is the ancestor of UCD, also had French, German, Italian from the foundation. And then, 30 years later, when the Queen's Colleges merged with the Catholic University to form the RUI, that's the Royal University of Ireland, we see a really transformational moment for modern languages, because the RUI made a modern language compulsory for matriculation. So you couldn't get into an RUI college if you hadn't proven that you had a satisfactory level of French or German. For all its students, and even more revolutionary, and it's related to modern languages and gender history, from 1884 it deemed women eligible to be awarded degrees. Cambridge came around to this in 1948, so to give you know, a bit of perspective on it. So this had considerable influence on women's education. Women tended to be good at modern languages because traditionally they weren't given classics at school, so they could easily handle French, German. And many of the RUI's earliest female language graduates rose to positions of power, to professorships, when the RUI changed to its later incarnation, the National University, see, it's royal to national, the National University of Ireland in the 20th century. German was a matriarchy for most of the 20th century in Irish universities. So there's a very different story in Britain. It's about pace and impact. I mean, there's a shift from ancient to modern going on in Britain also, but the pace and impact here was much more striking.
Now, the book is called Foreign Tongues, but yes, our native tongue is also an important part of this story. You don't ignore this in the book. You described how the Irish language had been relegated to a secondary position with regard to English. And I mean, what was the relationship between the two languages at this time, the latter half of the 19th century?
Irish was the language of the domestic sphere, whereas you had to know English to engage in any kind of trade or any kind of business in public. English was all the time gaining ground and becoming the language. It was the language of power, the language of print culture.
And Daniel O'Connell is the archetype of this. O'Connell, in the home, the family all spoke in Irish, but he discouraged the speaking of Irish outside of the home.
And he encouraged his daughters to learn Italian and French, because he knew that in the public sphere, to be taken seriously, especially at Westminster, English was the only language that counted.
And at around this time, mid-19th century, Irish seems to have been taught mostly for pastoral purposes. I mean, in terms of proselytism, I suppose,
well,
in terms of conversion.
It was, yes, it certainly was. Yeah, I mean, that would have been the in the early days of Trinity, there were people teaching Irish, and it was because of the Reformation. I mean, the difference between the two languages was solidified with the Reformation. Queen Elizabeth founded Trinity in 1592 to save her Irish subjects from popery. But at the same time, the Crown continued its Anglicisation project. But you can't really persuade a people to convert to your faith if they don't understand what you're talking about. It doesn't work. You have to proselytise in the language of the population you're trying to save.
So the King James Bible is translated into
Irish. And clerical students, Anglican clerical students, are taught a measure of Irish or a restricted amount of Irish. They read the Bible and so on. And you have Maynooth also, although Maynooth is less serious about Irish because it's too interested in modern languages.
And then, of course, towards the end of the 19th century, the teaching and learning of Irish became less about the religious or, you know, in some sense, the antiquarian aspects and more about its renewal and its central place in national identity, most obviously in the form of the Gaelic League. But there was a predecessor to the Gaelic League, wasn't there? The Society for the Preservation of the Irish language.
SPIL, yes. That was a couple of decades before the Gaelic League. And it was a very respectable group of people, including some clergymen of the Anglican persuasion, and also MPs and scholars who believed it was worth preserving because of the street cred that Old Irish had got, really from the groundbreaking work by German philologist Zeuss, Caspar Zeuss, who proved in 1853, 1854, thereabouts, that Irish was an Indo-European language. And there was a great deal of antiquarian interest, even from before that, in transcribing old Irish manuscripts. So it was worth preserving for that reason, but also the language, the modern language, as a way into understanding the structures of the older language. So the purpose of learning modern Irish before the Gaelic League was in order to study Old Irish better.
And how does the Gaelic League then advance the preservation of the Irish language and the dissemination of the Irish language?
Well, I think it copied the GAA structures. It had very strong grassroots organisation. The way it taught Irish was in a very different way from the way everybody had learned languages before, because the Gaelic Leaguers were in touch. They were all people who had studied modern languages before they studied Irish, and its movers and shakers, they were philologists interested in language study. And many of them were in touch with what was going on in Europe, with the latest trends in language teaching. I'm talking about the 1880s on. They were very interested in the new turn being taken in Germany and in other countries in the modern language classroom. Teachers were beginning to try direct methods. This is when the Berlitz School is founded. Interest in phonetics is growing. And it meant using the language being taught, that's the target language, as much as possible, promoting oral and aural skills over the written skills and avoiding the use of the mother tongue with absolutely no translation. This is a complete reversal of how anybody had learned languages themselves, any of them and any of their learners. So it was an exciting time. The early Gaelic League attracted lots and lots of people. Well, they had fesheanna as well, and they had folk competitions, and all that is well known. But in the classroom, I think their methods were revolutionary and were exciting for the teachers trying different methods and exciting for the learners. The heyday of the Gaelic League is one of joy and fun. The fin de siècle revivalists saw the Irish as inseparable from the wider world and part of European culture. So, to quote Liam McMahona, the world was a seamless cultural garment resplendent with a distinctive Irish hue. So they saw the two as, you know, they didn't see any contradiction in learning Irish and other modern languages.
Towards the end of the book, you look beyond the Victorians at the teaching of modern languages in Ireland since independence. And Irish accession to the EEC in 1973 marked, as it did in so many other respects of Irish life, a turning point for the study of modern languages, didn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about that process since our accession to what's now the European Union?
Yes, it did mark a turning point because interest in modern languages grew and everybody realised that the teaching of modern languages had been far too Victorian. The Victorian system had a very long shadow. But there were other reasons for that. It wasn't just EU accession. It was also changes in second language learning research. applied linguistics and such like, who were interested in the way people learn languages. So it's, the interest shifts to process and to a move away from Victorian language teaching, which is about content. The tipping point comes in the 1970s. Where Irish is concerned, the 1934 regulation that you had to pass Irish to get your Leaving Cert and you couldn't get a job in a state employment without proving that you had competence in Irish, that was reversed, and a much more relaxed approach has happened for learning Irish. For modern languages, I think the decommissioning of Latin is very important. It was the church abandoned Latin, but it wasn't just the church. It was in all over Europe, really. That's a very radical departure from the past. In fact, it's a departure not just from the Victorian past, but from centuries of language learning. It was part of the post-war context of broadening access because classics were viewed as elitist. So mandatory Latin for matriculation was abandoned gradually by university regulations. And that led to a drop in student take-up. With Latin gone, modern languages were left on their own, their sole foreign language teaching element to be cultivated in schools. But the classics had a long twilight in Ireland, as they did in Britain too, because teachers who had studied languages and studied Latin had learned modern languages in a traditional way and relied on Latin. So that it was only when there were no more teachers hired who had done Latin themselves that things became a real challenge, I think. However, they've got over it. So to sum up, the pendulum has swung towards functional communication, functional communicative teaching methods modelled on evidence-based research on how humans acquire foreign languages. And this all happened later for modern languages than it did for Irish, because I didn't mention the oral examining. Oral assessment in Irish came in 1960. It wasn't official for modern languages until 20 years later, the 1980s.
But despite all these changes, we're not really a multilingual society, are we?
We're certainly not. And of course, the obvious reason there is the ubiquity of English. In fact, the rise of global English was actually predicted, interestingly enough, by a Victorian professor. Well, he wasn't a professor, he was a lecturer. Frederick William O'Connell, who was... He became a 2RN figurehead, a very interesting character, Conall Cearnach. He wrote in an essay in 1922, and I quote, "We may assume that about the year 6000 AD, the whole earth will be of one speech, and that speech English. But it will not be the English of Shakespeare or Milton or Ruskin." But the transformation happened actually much faster than he predicted. I mean, 6000 AD.
Well, about 4000 years earlier than he predicted.
Yeah, you could say that. In fact, you see, that's the... I think it's very... It is true to say that we're not particularly good at learning modern languages. And I think one of the reasons in our defence is that tens of millions of the planet's population outside the English-speaking world now speak perfect English. And that's from Simon Cooper. So it's actually impossible to find a corner of the globe where the writ of the Anglo bubble doesn't run. And effective language learning can't be confined to the classroom. It has to be complemented by total immersion and with the chance to communicate on a sustained basis with first language users. But the latter are more likely to want to practice their often excellent English on the poor struggling Anglophones. So there's very little incentive to learn it seriously and give it the time, you know, compared to the past, when English didn't get you very far beyond Dover. So we really lack... The Irish have never travelled so much and as frequently. They've never had access to so many foreign tongues and ways of learning foreign tongues. But they find that when they're abroad, they've never had less need to know the language.
Yeah, the moment you start practicing your French on a French person, they recognise the accent,
that's
they speak
problem.
To you in English, and that's the end.
Whereas we put up with their accents and listen to them. Yeah. Utilitarian reasons for studying a language are the hardest to come up with. Simon Cooper says, try going to Sweden and speaking bad Swedish. You'll be forced into English in seconds. So Irish people have never had less need to learn a language. So I think we're thrown back on gratuitous motivations.
So despite such a rich history of language learning, as we've discussed, we remain one of the least multilingual countries in Europe. For anyone curious about how we got here, the book is called Foreign Tongues, Victorian Language Learning in Modern Ireland. It's published by UCD Press, and the author is my guest, Dr. Phyllis Gaffney. Phyllis, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me. Thank you, Miles.